Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are still in the New York ratification debates. And yeah, okay, so it does take, it's not one day's worth of points and comments that were part of this ratification debate. I mean, some of these comments were good, like the invasion part, the necessity of utilizing the forces within the Constitution to protecting the states from an invasion so that the states and the federal government are not caught holding the bag of supporting these invaders who are here. These are political combatants. These are not military combatants. They're coming so that they can engage, obtain access to unconstitutional things, and continue to grow access to more unconstitutional things. These people have no care for the, and I shouldn't say all of them, but I mean, you wouldn't come here illegally. You would at least follow the process, period. And you'd be an immigrant. I understand that we, you know, we're only limiting so many people right now to being able to legally come into the United States. Well, okay, that's it. That's our nation's security. That is our nation's choice of doing that. There's no nation in the world that has open borders to allow itself to be overran. If you want to look at the draconian practices of communist countries, they not only have guns on their border to defend people from coming in to overthrow them, they have guns pointing into their border, making sure the people can't get out. Now, the only reason China is allowing people to come here because they're bringing political activists down into Mexico along with drugs and everything else to undermine us. They are actively working against us. As you know, the show is sponsored by RepublicReview.org. And as you know, we have more of the ratification debates. This is the only show that provides this type of academic evidence, as well as the academic-based solutions. Where else are you going to go to get this type of content and information? It's not anywhere. It's only right here on Red State Talk Radio. Now, I'm going to just say this. I've been told, and I'm planning on trying to get to a point to every time I do my recordings, if you are a subscriber of the Reclaiming the Republic YouTube channel, when I record these shows, which we will have a camera, I have a face for radio, but I will actually be broadcasting the recording. So you're going to actually see how I record the show. You'll see the promos. You'll see a little bit of a gap between the promo and the coming back, you know, bumper music to come back in. So it'll be a little over 55 minutes. 55 and a half minutes is usually the recording time when we start our broadcasting. And so if you are a subscriber and you actually want to see, because some of these shows are being done in advance. I mean, literally, some of these shows I do like a week in advance. And if you're not doing anything on the weekend and you want to actually watch, and as you know, I'm not going to be good, but I will do everything I can to engage after the show with comments and so forth as we do this on YouTube. Now, I can tell you that because of the information, because of what we're doing, I'm surprised that YouTube has not shut us down yet. And I think that most people, I haven't been censored or shut down or put in jail from Facebook, except when I've actually posted out and engaged liberals where a liberal would, you know, turn me in and I would get in Facebook jail because of something I did on a page. I have never been in Facebook jail because of what I have posted on Mobius Strip Press, period. You go, if you're if you like that page or if you're following that page and you look at the different types of posts we put out there, and I've not been active on that for probably over a month just due to the fact that I had surgery a month prior to getting all ready for it. And so, you know, my activity's kind of gone down a little bit. But for the most part, my point is that we're going to start trying to push the envelope for those of you who are subscribers, who get those RSS feeds, you know, they're broadcasting a live show, or they're actually showing you the live taping. I still edit the audio side that actually goes out over Red State Talk Radio, because I want to give you the best possible audio. And sometimes that takes a long time, as I told you before. Anywho, we have our comment line, 425-270-5416. If you have any questions, you can always comment. And as a matter of fact, when we do the YouTube Live, when people actually call, I'll actually see the emails and say, hey, so we just got a phone call from somebody. We will make sure we play that in the next broadcast if it's not a content broadcast. What's a content broadcast? When I am going through the ratification debates, when I'm going through the resolutions, when I am reading the framers' words, I won't be able to take the time to do that. But when we're in a marketing, and I try to make sure we'll have plenty of marketing and plenty of time to engage so that if necessary, we'll call you back. We'll have that dialogue. We'll have that conversation and you will be on the air. So anyway, if that's what you're seeking, I know that there's a lot of people that are very apprehensive. And as a matter of fact, here's one of my biggest problems. And this happens all the time because a good friend of mine who is a huge supporter, he's in a very technical profession where people have, you know, continued education and so forth. Anyway, everybody that he works with, you know, has, you know, serious degrees, certifications and so forth. And so he actually talks to people and says, hey, man, you know, you should call this guy. Here's his email. Contact him. And, you know, every time he starts talking to people, they get all excited. Wow, this is awesome. And then he tells them, hey, well, give the guy a call. Send him an email. Almost inevitably, everybody says, oh, well, you know, let me get smart first. The common problem I have is the people are afraid of sounding stupid or thinking that I'm going to, you know, blast them, because as you listen to Levin, I mean, he has no problems yelling at people and berating them. I mean, I have to feel like you have either offended me or something like that. It's not my natural character to go after somebody like that. And I abhor people that do that. I just think that that's one that's rude. It's boorish. And it, you know, people deserve dignity. They deserve respect. Anyway, let's get into the ratification debates. And so Hamilton just talked about the supremacy and the necessity of having the supremacy of laws for both the federal and state courts, and as well as taxing and so forth. And now Hamilton gets into taxation, and this is what he says, and this happens to be on Saturday, June 28th, okay? And this is one of the last comments he makes for the day. I shall proceed now more particularly to the proposition before the committee. This clearly admits that the unlimited power of taxation, and he's emphasizing unlimited power of taxation, which I've been contending for, is proper. It declares that after the states have refused to comply with the requisitions, the general government may enforce its demands. While the gentleman's proposition and principle admit this in its fullest latitude, the whole course of the states is against it. The mode they point out would involve many inconveniences against which they would wish to guard. Suppose the gentleman's scheme should be adopted. Would not all the resources of the country be equal in the power of Congress? The states have but one opportunity of refusal. after having passed through the empty ceremony of a requisition, the general government can enforce all of its demands without limitation or resistance. The states will either comply or they will not. If they comply, they are bound to collect the whole of the tax from the citizens. The people must pay it. What then? Will the disadvantage of this being levied and collected by Congress in the first instance, it has been proved as far as probabilities can go that the federal government will, in general, take the laws of the several states as it rules and pursue those measures to which the people are most accustomed. Now, let's be clear. The people were never really inconvenienced by federal taxes because the federal government was able to live well within its means by all of the goods that were coming in and the taxes being levied on those goods. But if the states do not comply, what is the consequence? If the power of compulsion be a misfortune to the state, they must now suffer it without opposition or complaint. I shall show, too, that they must feel in an aggravated degree. It may frequently happen that though the states formally comply to the requisitions, the avails will not be fully realized by Congress. The states may be perfect timing for a really tough word to pronounce. I will give you this word as we come back, and we'll start it off back where, you know, it may frequently happen. So we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we figured out how to pronounce it. It's not that difficult, but when you're reading along and it's a word you usually don't use, then it kind of throws you off. And so, you know, you go, what? So anyway, it may frequently happen that though the states formally comply with the requisitions, the avails will not be fully realized by Congress. The states may be dilatory in the collection and payment and may from excuses for not paying the whole. Now, dilatory, what does that mean? Maybe slow, you know, arduous and burdensome. Anyway, There may also be partial compliances which will subject the union to inconveniences. Congress, therefore, in laying the tax, will calculate for these losses and inconveniences. They will make allowances for the delays and delinquencies of the states and apportion their burdens accordingly. They will be induced to demand more than their actual wants because they have to pay their bills. The federal government must be able to pay its bills. I get that. And so this is something that was, you know, this was a huge concern in many of these debates. And this is why they go through this pretty clearly. And when they set the pace, when they actually get out, I mean, look what Andrew Jackson was able to do by increasing some taxes. And even though in those days it wasn't that burdensome, as most people would have suggested, the reason why the taxes or the spending is out of control is because they're spending on money. They're spending money on things they have no constitutional power to do. Therefore, we must get them into compliance or they will bankrupt us and convince us that this is a legitimate bankruptcy. It's not. It's a fraudulent bankruptcy because the federal government has no authority to spend money on social engineering, on giving money to other, you know, nations for abortion and any of those types of things. They can't do it. And so they're causing a problem that we are going to have to reckon sooner rather than later. Because if it's later, it may be too late, if you understand my point. Now, Mr. Treadwell gets into the conversation regarding martial law and exclusive legislation. Now, I will tell you that I believe this is the very last. No, there's one more comment that will be coming from, and it looks like Mr. Lansing. And so, bottom line, we're almost through the New York ratification debates, and we still got a good portion of the show to go through. Anyway, with regards to martial law, Mr. Treadwell, on July 2nd, this is what he had to say. Why is it that the said privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless in cases of a rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it? What clause in the Constitution, except this very clause itself, gives the general government a power to deprive us of that great privilege so sacredly secured to us by our state constitutions? Why is it provided that no bill of attainder shall be passed or that no title of nobility shall be granted? Are there any clauses in the Constitution extending the powers of the general government to these objects? Some gentlemen say that these, though not necessary, were inserted for a greater caution. I have wished, sir, that a greater caution had been used to secure to us the freedom of election, a sufficient and responsible representation, the freedom of the press, and the trial by jury, both in civil and criminal cases. And he goes on and on. But the whole point is that he's making an excellent point. And the only place where they constitutionally, you know, basically amend the Constitution is in the Virginia ratification debates, because he's talking about martial law. When you suspend the application of law and be able to not have to provide writs of habeas corpus and so forth, that's when martial law is declared. Now, what are the parameters for martial law? Why isn't that in the Constitution? It is. It's not written in the Constitution. It is clarified in the ratification debates. This is why I'd highly recommend you read my article on martial law in the 21st century. If you do, you will find that Mason, Madison, Nicholas, and a lot of the men in the Virginia ratification debates clarify how martial law can be declared. Martial law can only be declared in the area to where the militia is being deployed. In other words, there first has to be an insurgency, because that we have these insurgencies and they're not deploying the militia, they can't declare martial law in Portland and Seattle, in Minneapolis and all these other cities when they need to declare martial law to go in there, arrest these people and throw them in jail and, you know, charge them for insurgencies and so forth. These people are treasonous bastards. Excuse me. I'm sorry. These people are treasonous and need to be arrested and handled appropriately as insurgents should be handled. So martial law has got an important place in enforcing the rule of law. Of course, we don't want to just willy-nilly use martial law like they did with the Civil War. Where was my mind? When Lincoln declared martial law, he did it unconstitutionally because he didn't deploy the militia. You want to be able to declare martial law, you must be able to deploy the militia into the areas of effect. In other words, where the invasion is occurring. We've got an invasion so broad that we'll need to deploy the militia through every state when we start rounding up all of the illegals to send them back to their home countries so that if they really want to become a citizen of the United States, they can go through the immigration process and not invade us. Look, we've got 40 million invaders in America today. You cannot tell me that that is not creating an overwhelming burden financially, politically, and so forth. And the fact is that Congress is obligated to support the Constitution. In other words, Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution states and dictates that the United States shall guarantee to every state a republican form of government and protect each state from an invasion. Where's our protection? Secondly, Congress has very specific guidance in what to do when an invasion occurs. That Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15, Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to repel an invasion. That is what they are obligated to do. They're not obligated to put down these facilities for receiving and catching and releasing. That's not in the Constitution, but what is in the Constitution is deploying the militia and repelling invasions. You see how easy this is when we live by the rule of law and what the cost and the magnitude of the problem they're creating by not supporting the Constitution? Here's the beauty, my friends. If you've seen my immigration video on our YouTube channel, you need to see this because we even connect the dots to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. If you do not support your oath of office by supporting the Constitution, by deploying the militia to stopping this invasion, then you are supporting rebellion against the Constitution and are disqualified per Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and must be removed and banished from public service for life. Let's start following the rule of law. This doesn't require a judge to get involved and to try to use case law. It is very clear in the Constitution that all public servants must support the Constitution, and the Constitution clearly states what to do in the case of an invasion. Not to be left to interpretation of judges and activists in court. Any judge that actually starts supporting this invasion is equally violating their oath of office because they too are supposed to support the Constitution and not try to find holes in ravaging our constitutional republic. We're not pulling the punches. What's in the Constitution is in the Constitution, and we have a right to enforce it. And who's supposed to enforce it? We the people. Who's we the people? We are the militia, the unorganized and organized. We are the ones that are the ultimate checks and balances over our government. It's that simple. We do not have to allow this Bolshevik revolution to continue. We do not have to allow any of this crap to continue. We have the law on our side. And this is why you hear me say this all the time. Only the good Lord knew. Only the good Lord knew what we would be facing in these days. And he gave us everything we needed in the Constitution as well as that 14th Amendment, which is also in the Constitution. to do everything we need in getting the federal government back into full compliance to the Constitution. Isn't this great? Isn't it great to know that we've had such an omnipotent influence in the making of this country? That the divine hand of providence has blessed us not only with this great government, but everything necessary to maintain this great government and even to restore it to its fullest potential. Wow. Anywho, I'm going to have a lot of editing over these past couple of shows because I can tell you there's been a little bit of passion thrown out here. Anyway, exclusive legislation. This is also Mr. Treadwell. And oh, we're going straight into a promo, so please stay tuned. We will get into this exclusive legislation, and then later on we will get into, I think it's Mr. Lansing's exclusive legislation. And when we come back, I'll talk to you about the importance of exclusive legislation regarding the statehood of Washington, D.C. We'll be right back after these two promos. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so this next comment by Mr. Treadwell is about exclusive legislation. And there was a baffling or a conundrum because many people didn't understand. They actually saw with the seat of Continental Congress existing in a particular state that it did, that there were some errors of manipulation, errors of attachments to the general government and that state government. One of the things that they wanted to do, and it was very clear in the Constitutional Convention, is they did not want to have any intermingling of the national or the general government and the state government. The creation of a state flies in the face of the Constitution and the need for its autonomy and the need for maintaining the ability of legislation for the seat of government. In other words, Congress has exclusive legislation. They're not to have a city council. They're not to have a mayor for the District of Columbia. They're the ones that are to create the the laws that are to be enforced. They're supposed to be full-time engaged in managing the District of Columbia, not allowing some governor to, or I should say some mayor and city council and other people to be able to do these things. They do have the ability to have their own police force to enforce the laws that they create. This is one of the reasons why when we get into the Virginia ratification debates, I think it's Mason that casts this really dark view of the District of Columbia, that the general government will be like witches stirring a cauldron of casting spells and wickedness in that area of the District of Columbia. But it is very clear that the District of Columbia is to remain autonomous from any form of state government. This concept of what they're doing in trying to create this state government it flies in the face of how the Constitution was to be done. It also creates a violation of the Constitution because here now the Section 1 or Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17, the exclusive legislation of the District of Columbia must be amended. You can't just create a state. You have to amend the Constitution and get 38 states to agree that the exclusive legislation by Congress will no longer exist over the District of Columbia, over the city or state of the District of Columbia. And there's no way it would pass. What they're trying to do is they're trying to do an end run around the Constitution. And what has to happen is the attorney generals of states need to sue the District of Columbia in trying to obtain statehood without amending the Constitution first. You can't become a state, you can't become a territory, and you can't be on the pathway of being a state without amending the Constitution first. And so now you know what's going to be in my constitutional minute coming up very soon. But anyway, let me get into Mr. Treadwell's comments. Again, anti-federalist views, none of these really have any effect, but here is some very interesting insights. The plan of the federal city, sir, departs from every principle of freedom as far as the distance of the two polar stars from each other. For subjecting the inhabitants of that district to the exclusive legislation in Congress, in whose appointment they have no share or vote, is laying a foundation on which may be erected as complete a tyranny as may be found in the Eastern world, China. Nor do I see how this evil can possibly be prevented without raising the foundation of this happy place where men are to live without labor upon the fruit of the labors of others. This political hive where all the drones in the society are to be collected to feed on the honey of the land. How dangerous this city may be and what its operations on the general liberties of this country time must discover. But I pray God it may not prove to this Western world what the city of Rome enjoying a similar constitution did to the Eastern. There is another clause in this constitution, and this is the interesting one here. They're both interesting. There's another clause within this constitution which, though there is no prospect of getting it amended, I think ought to be passed over in silence. Least such a silence should be construed as a tactic of approbation of it. I mean the clause which restricts the general government from putting a stop for a number of years to the commerce, which is a stain to the commerce of civilized nation and has already blackened half the plains of America with a race of wretches made by so our cruel policy and avarice, and which appears to me to be already repugnant to every principle of humanity, morality, religion, and good policy. He's talking about the slave trade and not shutting it down and not shutting down slavery, period. There are other objections to this Constitution which are weighty and unanswerable, but they have been so clearly stated and so fully debated in the course of this discussion that it would be unjustifiably an intrusion on patience of the House to repeat them. I shall therefore content myself with a few observations on the general plan and tendency. We are told that this federal government, I think, sir, there is as much propriety in the name as in that which it advocates, assumes, and no more. It is, in my idea, as complete a consolidation as the government of this state, in which legislative powers to a certain extent are exercised by the several towns and corporations. The sole difference between a state government under this Constitution and a corporation under the state government is that a state, being more extensive than a town, its powers are likewise proportionably extended, but neither of them enjoys the least share of sovereignty. For, let me ask, what is a state government? What sovereignty, what power is left to it when the control of every source of revenue and total command of the militia are given to the general government? And so he kind of goes on, but the important part that what I really wanted to share with you was, they actually brought up the argument of the slave trade and how repugnant it was and how it needed to be brought up or at least mentioned, and the moral objections that Mr. Treadwell had. Anyway, the last comment we have, and I believe this is Mr. Langsing. Let me see. It's Monday, July 7th. The secretary continued reading the fourth and fifth articles without interruption to the second clause of Article 6. Mr. Langsing proposed the following amendments, and then he went through these resolved amendments. And in his resolved amendments, this is what he provided. This was the amendment that he suggested on exclusive legislation. Resolved, as the opinion of this committee, that the right of the Congress to exercise exclusive legislation over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may, by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of government of the United States, shall not be so exercised as to exempt the inhabitants of such district from paying the same taxes, duties, imposts, and excises as shall be imposed on the other inhabitants of the state where such districts may be, or shall it be so exercised as to prevent the laws of the state and all process under those laws from extending to such district in all cases of crimes committed without the district or cases of contracts made between persons residing within such district and persons residing without it, nor shall it be exercised as to authorize any inhabitant of the said district to bring any suit in any court which may be established by Congress within the same against any citizen or person not an inhabitant of the said district. And it is understood that the stipulations of this Constitution respecting all essential rights shall extend as well to this district as the United States in general. Resolved further, as the opinion of this committee, that the right of exclusive legislation with respect to such places as may be purchased for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, and dockyards, and other needful buildings shall not be construed to authorize Congress to make any law to prevent the laws of the states in which they may lie from extending such places in all civil and criminal matters, except as to such persons as shall be in the service of the United States, nor to them with respect to crimes committed without such places. Now, you do realize that when we look at the District of Columbia and the limitations on the federal government over crime, the District of Columbia was going to have to, or I should say Congress, was going to have to start creating their own, you know, definitions of crimes for the District of Columbia, for murder, for theft, and all of these things, and have an enforcement of those crimes. That was all considered a part of Congress's responsibility. And so with that, we basically have concluded the entire or at least the highlights that I chose to give you out of the entire New York ratification debates. Now, of course, there wasn't really any epiphany or the partings of the heaven, but we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so here's kind of an interesting turn. But before we take the interesting turn, let me kind of close the books here. As I proved to you that this really, the New York ratification debates was not parting the heavens. Madison, I should say Hamilton, I don't know why, you know, other than the fact that I'm just always that challenged when it comes to names. Hamilton was I think he was pulling his punches because he did not want to be legally bound in having to say anything. He knew that if Virginia ratified, that New York would ratify as well, and he could do it without him having to testify in creating clarity and legal definitions that might be too good that he would be basically tied, and the ability for him to undermine the federal government down the road because he knew and he wanted to have his involvement, and he was involved as much as he possibly could. Even though he wasn't involved in Adams's administration, where do you think Adams got this list of names of these midnight judges that Adams put into place before Jefferson took office? Well, they just didn't come out of thin air. And the one guy that had access to all of these legal minds wasn't John Adams. John Adams was, John Adams was a best of recluse. He was not well received by many people. I mean, he was considered, I guess the best way to say it is he was pompous. He was a blowhard. He wasn't in, even though he may have had power and people still was respectful to him because of his position. This John Adams wasn't a guy that was out there, you know, as a man of the people. He didn't get and didn't understand the nuances of this Constitution either. He was over in Europe just like Jefferson was when the Constitution was written and ratified. He was a man of opinion, and he was very well versed, and he had the talent of telling you what was on his mind. Or he was one of those people that, you know, had no reservation, almost like with Tourette's, of telling you what he thought. And so John Adams and his accepting some of the guidance, because you could see Hamilton, even though he wasn't directly involved for the entire tenure of Adams' administration, he was still feeding Adams information. And Adams realized that Hamilton was a shifty character, but when it came to stuffing the courts, he needed names, and he felt and he agreed with the stuffing of the courts or these midnight appointments. So that's what he did based on Hamilton's prodding. So if there's anything you take out of this part of the ratification debates, is that Hamilton really started showing his colors from the ratification debates on. The Federalist Papers, it seemed like, boy, this guy's pretty good Federalist. He has a grasp of it. But things started changing. And I think we've proven this. If you look, and I just went through the entire ratification debates regarding enumerated powers. I did the exact same searches as, you know, looking for very specific types of phrases and anything like that. And why is it that Hamilton didn't come out and, you know, make the same types of assertions as he did with the Federalist Papers? One can only deduce that this is literally because Hamilton didn't want to tie his hands. He wanted to be able to swing from tree to tree and so forth and be able to make up everything as he went along without having to be encumbered by his own words. Now, he understood contract law. He understood that how the Constitution was explained and described was legally binding, which is why he and John Marshall quickly moved away from utilizing, and they buried the ratification debates at the beginning of the Republic. When they created this new government, they all just kind of agreed that they would work together in moving it forward based on these common understandings. But nowhere did they say, you know what, we need to actually pull these ratification debates out, because there were some very specific words that provided detail and clarification, and we need to be going by those. And Hamilton knew this. Madison knew this as well, but Madison in 1821 pointed to the ratification debates and says, it doesn't matter what any of us thought this Constitution meant during the Constitutional Convention. The only thing that matters is what the states understood the Constitution to be at the time of ratification, which is Madison pointing to the concept of contract law and how the contract was stipulated, clarified, and defined. This way, it became legally binding definitions. And in Madison's mind, that's how it was. Hamilton's mind, no. He wanted ambiguity. He wanted taffy for a constitution so he could stretch it in any direction he wanted. And if you haven't garnered yet, I am not a fan of Hamilton, if you have not garnered. And I will be the first to throw that out there to attest and to confess that I looked at him as a nefarious player, especially as I really started seeing a bigger picture of his life and his effects and how he went through his life. And anyway, I don't want to get into the personal side of all of this, so let's move on to the North Carolina debates. Now, North Carolina was actually a little bit bigger state than New York. They had 50,000 more people at the time of ratification than New York did. So that's 50,000 people. That's a good town, right? If we look at North Carolina and we look at New York, North Carolina actually looked at the Constitution more discernment and more of a discerning eye than New York did. Now, here's the interesting thing. They didn't ratify the Constitution of the United States until 1789. So the first year of the federal government forming, North Carolina was not involved because they couldn't come to an agreement of ratifying the Constitution. They said, well, we need to have another convention later because they ran out of time. And so there's no doubt in my mind that North Carolina goes, oh, man, we really missed the opportunity to be in this at the very beginning. Now, North Carolina being a slave state, they did talk. We'll get into some of their positions on slavery, Mr. Iredell and some others. But what we also want to get into is how they viewed the Constitution in its limit. You're going to find that North Carolina debated and clarified the Constitution, and Mr. Iredell was far more of a statesman regarding the limitations of the Constitution than Alexander Hamilton was. Why is that? Well, again, the duplicity of Alexander Hamilton. And that's basically all I can say. I mean, that's how we have to boil it down, right? Okay, so anyway, let me just move into the ratification debates of North Carolina. And so we start off with Mr. Codwell complaining about this "we the people" thing. Now, Patrick Henry did the same thing, and I don't think I go into much detail on the Virginia, but I want to cover this here and now so that you understand the "we the people" and the paradigm as people started perceiving this new government. And so this is what Mr. Caldwell was the one that was making the comment. He says, "Mr. Chairman, if they mean we the people at large, I conceive the expression is improper. Were not they who framed this Constitution the representatives of the legislature of the different states? In my opinion, they had no power from the people at large to use their name or to act for them. They were not delegated for that purpose." And Mr. McLean comes up and says, now this is, Mr. McLean is a Federalist. And he says, "The reverend gentleman has told us that the expression, we the people, is wrong because the gentlemen who framed it were not the representatives of the people. I readily grant that they were delegated by states, but they did not think that they were the people, but intended it for the people at a future day. The sanction of the state legislatures was in some degree necessary. It was to be submitted by the legislatures to the people so that when it is adopted, it is the act of the people. When it is the act of the people, their name is certainly proper. This is very obvious and plain to any capacity." Now, I want to be clear here. There is not one ratification debate that has "we the people" at it. When we look at those who attend the ratification debates, we will find that these are representatives of the people, not the people themselves. It's still a Republican form of government. And so when Madison brought his retort, and I will get into Madison's retort to Patrick Henry, what Madison says is, who are the parties to it? We the people? No. We the states. The states are the parties, and it is we the people of the 13 sovereign states. And so he kind of clarifies that it is the states, but we the people as in a representative government with delegates and so forth, but it was not intended to create a democracy or that type of paradigm. We'll be back with more North Carolina in our next episode. I'm Chair Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and Republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.